Bienvenidos a Crónicas de la Raza. Welcome to La Raza Chronicles. On today's program, we focus on Honduras. We hear about the trial of ex-president
Juan Orlando Hernández, who was convicted of narco trafficking and weapons charges. We'll go to that interview first. Then the second half of our program will be focused on the incredible musician Omar Sosa. You'll hear a little bit about him, his music, his upcoming shows, and he will be featured on this program. All this and much more, stay tuned. You're listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. I'm very lucky to have on the line with me Karen Spring, who is the co-coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network and who attended the historic trial of former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernández. And that trial ended last week, but we're really grateful to be able to have you on the line, Karen, to give us some context on what's been happening in Honduras in terms of what led up to this trial, especially since it was a very historic moment, and more about the results. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And just to give a little bit of context to the trial, basically since 2009, so that's maybe 15 years ago, there was a military coup in Honduras that was backed by the United States. And the coup basically ushered in 12 years of a very complex human rights crisis in Honduras. And with that coup, we heard in the trial all about how basically drug cartels began to take over the state of Honduras. And at the time of the coup and in the aftermath of the coup, I lived and worked in Honduras throughout all of those years. We didn't really necessarily know that a drug cartel was taking over the government of Honduras, but there was very clear signs that things were not going very well. And so, for example, many people in the United States know that that's when there was a lot of discussion about the migrant crisis. Lots of Central Americans and a lot of Hondurans were fleeing Honduras. Honduras became one of the most dangerous countries in the Western Hemisphere, particularly for land defenders, environmentalists, lawyers, and journalists. And so that is sort of the context in which this trial took place in New York. I guess it was mid-February it began, and we heard a lot about dating the times in Honduras, dating all the way back to the 2009 coup.
That's the voice of Karen Spring, who is with Honduras Solidarity Network. We're happy to have you on to get this update, because really what we're hearing often is just more about the aftermath of the coup. People talk about how the rate of homicides or the lack of investigation of violent crimes and just the lack of accountability and just the general fear and why people leave Honduras. That is what we hear about in the news. So why don't you give us a sense, what have things been like for people since the coup, and put that in context of this trial? Why is it so important that we're finally having some sort of process to hold some accountability?
Sure. So in the 15 years following the coup, I lived and worked in Honduras, and I've been working very closely with communities and organizations that are fighting back or opposing foreign investments specifically. So we're talking about investment in tourism, you know, large resorts or gated communities that are being built by Americans and Canadians on the north coast of Honduras, for example, or indigenous communities fighting the construction of hydroelectric dams in their on their ancestral lands. In western Honduras is another example. And then also just communities that are caught in the crossfire in drug interdiction operations led by the DEA in Honduras as part of the war on drugs in Central America. And so Honduras, at the same time as it became a very violent place to live, a very violent country where the majority of the population live in poverty. We saw that the governments of Honduras that took over the state following the 2009 coup were very much favorable to US and Canadian interests. And so that's why we saw the influx of a lot of foreign companies in Honduras, which were opposed by a large majority of the population. And I'm talking about the population that don't feel like they were part of the political process or the economic system, people that really struggled to make ends meet day to day. And so the trial that started in mid-February in the Southern District Court in New York, what it was basically focused on was the rise of a narco state in Honduras, basically since that 2009 coup. And so what happened is the United States government, after so many years of supporting the post-coup governments, one was the President Porfirio Lobo Sosa, and the second was President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who just left office in 2022. So after Juan Orlando Hernandez left office in 2022, the United States decided to ask for Juan Orlando Hernandez, or Ho, as people commonly refer to him as by his initials, they asked for his extradition to the United States on drug trafficking charges. And so this trial was an attempt to hold the Ho, President Ho, or ex-President Ho, responsible for trafficking thousands of kilos of cocaine into the United States. And so what is so interesting about this trial, particularly for your audience, is that, you know, the United States government, because President Ho was so favorable to U.S. interests and to U.S. foreign companies over during his two terms in the presidency, the United States supported him very, very extensively. From 2014, when he first took office, up until he left office in 2022. And so all of a sudden, he came out of office in 2022, and the United States said, we're going to try him and accuse him of basically trafficking drugs over the two terms of his presidency, but also basically since the 2009 coup. And so in the courtroom in the Southern District Court of New York, we saw the United States basically try one of its biggest allies in Latin America for over a month, basically, that the trial took place. And then he was found guilty on three counts of drug trafficking and weapons-related charges. So it was very surprising in the sense that we know that the United States, through the President Obama, through President Trump and Biden, basically supported Juan Orlando Hernandez. And then now they basically tried one of their biggest allies on the war on drugs and the war against organized crime in Honduras, because he was doing exactly what they said, the United States government said, that they were trying to crack down on, like alongside this ally, which was Juan Orlando Hernandez, for so many years.
That's the voice of Karen Spring. We're talking about the recent ruling that was against Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, and Karen Spring is with the Honduras Solidarity Network. As you mentioned, this case wrapped up. He was found guilty. What did you, or what can we learn from this case? What evidence was new? I know that the law was already known, but what can we take from this case? And tell us a little bit about the demands that Honduras Solidarity Network has put forth.
So as the trial was taking place in New York, the Honduras Solidarity Network launched a campaign. And our campaign was called Putting the U.S. and Canada on Trial for Supporting and Legitimizing and Backing a Narco State in Honduras. Because what we wanted to do during this trial was have the conversation that you and I are now having about the fact that Juan Orlando Hernandez was such a strong U.S. ally over so many years. And so the campaign that we launched was all about having this conversation about this big elephant in the courtroom. And the elephant is this U.S. support. The U.S. is now trying one of their biggest allies, but they're not talking about the fact that one of the reasons that Juan Orlando Hernandez enjoyed such incredible power and support over those 8 years he was in office was exactly because of the United States government. And so the Honduras Solidarity Network launched this campaign, and we have very specific demands that are linked to the U.S. role in Honduras. Because while, you know, Hondurans have achieved a small amount of justice now that Juan Orlando Hernandez has been tried and found guilty in New York courts, there's been no accountability in the United States for the support that the U.S. gave to Juan Orlando Hernandez while he was trafficking drugs into the U.S. And so one of our two major demands, and we have five demands in total, but one of our two major demands is that we are asking for inquiries and investigations in the United States about the U.S. role in both the 2009 coup in Honduras, which basically laid the conditions of the narco state in Honduras. And we're also asking for investigations into the role that the United States played in training, funding, and legitimizing Juan Orlando Hernandez, but also in funding the Honduran police and military. Because as we heard in the trial in New York, the police and military in Honduras were fundamental to helping traffic these drugs. And so they were not only committing violations against, you know, the land defenders and the environmentalists and the journalists that were being killed in Honduras following the 2009 coup, but the police and military were also assisting in trafficking these drugs, and they were receiving training from the FBI, from special forces in the United States, from the Canadian military, from the Green Berets and in the United States. And so we want to draw out that role, and we want there to be some level of accountability. So that's why we're calling for public investigations, Senate investigations in the United States. But we're also calling for a declassification of documents that link to the U.S. role in Honduras. We feel that declassification of documents will begin to expose and show and demonstrate the role that the United States played in Juan Orlando Hernandez's rise to power and basically keeping him in power over 8 years, despite the fact that there were very clear warning signs coming from solidarity organizations in the United States, but also coming from policymakers in DC that were saying, you know, things are not going very well in Honduras. There are very extreme violations. The United States should suspend support for Juan Orlando Hernandez. And we were totally ignored over many, many years.
That's the voice of Karen Spring with the Honduras Solidarity Network. So those are some of the demands that you all have put forth. And with this guilty verdict, what are you hearing on the ground? And what can also people do as you're hearing people, your colleagues, your friends in Honduras? I know you've been on the ground in Honduras for many, many times of the since post his time in power. What are you hearing on the ground of what people want, us as people in the United States who are in many ways, you know, our tax dollars are in part responsible for some of the atrocious practices in terms of lack of accountability? You know, we have so many ways that the U.S. has been a deep part of the destabilization of Honduras. So what are you hearing from your friends and colleagues in terms of what they want us to do and also how people are feeling post-verdict results?
When I was in New York attending the trial, there were Hondurans that came in from all over the United States. And even some Hondurans that, you know, the ones that have the ability were actually flew in from Honduras to attend the trial. Because I think for many, this trial, even though it was held in the United States and not in Honduras, and Ho was being tried by a very strong ally over many years, for Hondurans, this guilty verdict was a tiny bit of justice that many have wanted for many, many years. Because, you know, even though Juan Orlando Hernandez is being tried for the least of his crimes, because in Honduras, he was involved in corruption scandals that basically saw the complete depletion of the Social Security Institute or the Social Security system in Honduras. He was involved in murdering pro-democracy protesters in Honduras. He still has not been held accountable for any of those crimes in Honduras and in the courts in Honduras. And so I think that there's still a lot to be done in Honduras in relation to the justice that people are still seeking, both in relation to Juan Orlando Hernandez, but also for all the people that supported him over so many years that are still very much present in Honduras and flourishing in Honduras and doing well in Honduras. And so I think that there's still a lot of struggle and resistance that will take place in Honduras fighting for justice in Honduras. But I also wanted to mention something that the Hondurans that came to the trial, there was the final 2 days while we were waiting for the verdict in the case. There was a vigil held outside of the Southern District Court, and a vigil that Hondurans themselves organized, and they published or they printed pictures of victims, of many victims that have lost their lives over so many years, and placed them on the ground outside of the court alongside candles and small little flags, Honduran flags, with, you know, protest banners saying, you know, justice is still wanted for all of these cases. And so I think that that is a really important message, that there's still so much more to be done in Honduras. And I think that that's a project that Hondurans have been involved in for many years. They still continue to demand that there be responses in Honduras. But I think more broadly, when we look at the role of the United States in Honduras, I think that since Juan Orlando Hernández left power, the United States continues to interfere in what's happening in Honduras, basically preventing this new government, which is sort of seen as sort of a post-narco state government under President Xiomara Castro, who's the first woman president in Honduras. A lot of people in Honduras are saying, you know, the United States needs to stop intervening in what's going on in this country, and they need to let Hondurans choose how they want to govern their own country, and also how they want to achieve justice for the justice that still is lacking in the country. And although many are happy that Ho will faces a minimum of 40 years in prison after being found guilty on drug trafficking and weapons charges, I think that Hondurans will continue to embark on this journey of justice in their own countries. And I think us as US citizens or US residents and North American residents, we need to call on our government to stop intervening, to allow Hondurans to build the country that they want, so that many of them don't have to leave Honduras, and many of them are forced to leave because of the conditions that the United States government creates or contributes to creating in Honduras. And so as part of this campaign, putting the US and Canada on trial, one of our demands is to stop US intervention in Honduras. And so we are asking people to join our actions on the Honduras Solidarity Network's Twitter and Facebook. We have posted actions where we're asking organizations to sign on to a sign-on letter, basically calling for our demands. That's public investigations in the United States about the role of the United States, declassifying documents related to the U.S. role since the coup in Honduras, but also to stop the U.S. in intervening in what's going on in Honduras currently, so that Hondurans can once again rebuild Honduras after, you know, this narco state took over the country. So people can find all those actions at hondurasnow.org, which is our website, or by going to the Honduras Solidarity Network Facebook and Twitter.
Thank you so much. That's the voice of Karen Spring from Honduras Solidarity Network. So you've given us some great ways to actually do something, so to have actions that we can take at this moment to be a part of calling attention to the important next steps for minimizing or at least addressing the interventions that have happened from the U.S. in Honduras. And you've given us the Twitter information, etc. It is really tricky to get more complete information around what's happening in Honduras, so I'm imagining that the website is a great place to go. Is there anything else that you recommend in terms of places people can go to get more accurate information around what's happening in Honduras, to understand more about the work you all are doing? Or is there anything else you think is important for our listeners to know about the work you all do?
So I think that if your listeners are interested in following what's going on in Honduras, there's some really fantastic Spanish-speaking media from Honduras. One of them is an independent online media outlet that's called Criterio.hn. So that's Criterio.hn. That's a really fantastic sort of more independent media. There's also a wonderful radio station that's Jesuit-led in Honduras called Radio Progreso. I would encourage people to listen to those news outlets that talk extensively about the role of the U.S., but also, you know, what's going on in Honduras from a Honduran perspective. There's also wonderful organizations like COPIN, which is an indigenous organization, OFRENE, That people can follow. And we at the Honduras Solidarity Network, we retweet and we promote a lot of these voices on our Twitter. We also post news, monthly news summaries of news in Honduras at hondurasnow.org. That's also a podcast that I host. And so that's more English speaking media. And we basically replicate the voices of Honduran organizations and Honduran media. So yes, people can go to hondurasnow.org for all the information about our campaign, our actions that we're posting. You can also check out daily trial summaries of everything that was discussed in the trial of Juan Orlando Hernandez in New York, or check out our Twitter, Honduras Solidarity Network, and our Facebook.
That's the voice of Karen Spring. We've been really lucky to get this recap of what happened during the trial of former President of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was found guilty, you know, which confirms what everyone's been saying, that the U.S.-backed president was someone who was responsible for a narco state. And as Karen Spring's talking about, we want to make sure that we hold the U.S. accountable for its role in the, you know, the many, many, many ways that people are feeling less safe and less agency and less possibility for accountability in Honduras. Karen Spring, with your work with Honduras Solidarity Network, you were actually at this trial, you attended it, you did report backs, you talked about it on your radio program. Can you give us some of the highlights of things that, for us that, you know, I wasn't a part of the trial, I haven't been following it so closely, what are important takeaways?
Sure. So the trial basically took place over, I think it lasted about 3 weeks. And so it was a very intense trial schedule. It was a trial by jury. And it was held on the 26th floor of the Southern District Court, downtown Manhattan. Basically, the prosecution, or the U.S. prosecutors, really relied extensively on the testimony of drug traffickers or Honduran drug traffickers that had either been extradited from Honduras and that had worked alongside Juan Orlando Hernandez as part of the drug cartels and as part of the operation of trafficking cocaine into the United States. So there was a whole bunch of Honduran drug traffickers that took the stand and that were under oath, but also had cooperating agreements with the prosecution to basically tell the truth. And what they did is they sort of outlined all of these business operations, these drug trafficking operations and logistics about how cocaine was actually received in Honduras in small airplanes or small planes that were coming in from South America, and then they would unload them and they would traffic them across Honduras using the police and military. It really painted a really interesting picture of how cocaine operations and logistics occurred, especially when you put it into the context of the broader sort of war on drugs and just how much, you know, as you're listening to how cocaine in the courtroom was being trafficked over so many years and almost freely through Honduras, it really showed, at least for me, how much of the war on drugs, the U.S.-led war on drugs, is such a farce in so many ways. Because, you know, even though the United States was spending millions and millions of dollars to crack down on cocaine trafficking through Central America, you know, these co-conspirators or these individuals that testified in Juan Orlando Hernandez's trial were talking how freely it was able to basically be trafficked thanks to Juan Orlando Hernandez being in the presidency and allowing all of these cocaine operations to happen right under the nose of the DEA and the U.S. government. And so that was a really interesting sort of bits of information that came out in the trial. The second thing that came out in the trial that I think was really interesting and might be interesting to your listeners is that often the defense, so Juan Orlando Hernandez as his defense, you know, they don't actually take the stand often to testify. And Juan Orlando Hernandez, as the former president of Honduras, decided to take the stand and basically give his version of what happened and why he was being accused. And he obviously, one of the things that he did is that he basically said that, you know, he was not a drug trafficker. He denied all the allegations against him. But as he was denying all the allegations against him on the stand, as he was being questioned by his own attorneys and then cross-examined by U.S. prosecutors, who I'm sure just loved the opportunity to question this, you know, this former president, the accused in this case, Juan Orlando Hernandez made a lot of references to his relationship with the United States government, basically implying to the jury who was listening and to the people in the public, such as myself, that were there observing the trial, that he couldn't possibly be a drug trafficker because he had such a fantastic relationship with the US government. So Juan Orlando Hernandez referenced really extensively his meetings that he had in the FBI headquarters, with the CIA, you know, with the fact that he was such good friends with John Kelly, who's the former head of the US Southern Command. And then he went on, John Kelly went on to be the director of Homeland Security, I believe, under President Trump. And so that was really interesting because, you know, Juan Orlando Hernandez took the opportunity to sort of say, I am innocent. I am not guilty of these charges. I couldn't possibly be a drug trafficker because I was embraced so extensively by the US government. And these are all the ways that the US government worked with me and basically trusted me with information about drug operations in the country. So that was really interesting to see and to experience. And the courtroom obviously was filled when Juan Orlando Hernandez decided to take the stand, because it was the former president of the country deciding to take the stand and give his version of what had happened and why he was being accused. So the last thing I'm just going to mention really quickly, which I think is really important, especially for US audiences, is that we hear a lot about mass migration from Honduras to the US-Mexico border. And when we often hear about it in the mainstream media, we hear about gangs and street gangs that are driving people north and forcing people to leave their homes because of, you know, violence and war tax and threats from gang members. And one of the things that came out in this trial in the courtroom in New York was that Juan Orlando Hernandez worked very closely with some of these street gangs, specifically the MS-13. And this is something that we don't often hear about. We often hear that, you know, the state of Honduras is separate from, or it's, you know, different from these street gangs. Whereas in this New York court, we heard how much, you know, the Juan Orlando Hernandez was providing weapons to the MS-13 that are, you know, threatening and driving people out of their homes in, you know, the smallest places in Honduras, in urban centers, but also in rural areas in Honduras. We heard about how the MS-13 was trafficking drugs alongside the Honduran police under the command of and the direction of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And so as a human rights worker and someone that really listens to how the media sort of frames violence in Honduras, that was really important to hear that the presidency and all of the structures of the Honduran government, along with the police and the military and the MS-13, are all working together. And for me, it was a really clear indication of what happens when a drug cartel takes over a state. You have a complete infiltration of organized crime in the state. So Hondurans were never safe and are never safe from anything, you know, whether it's gang threats or whether they're drug cartels run by the former president of Honduras. That became very clear in this trial. And so I feel like those are probably the three main things that came out for me in the trial that were really important for a US audience. And I mean, I think that over the duration of 3 weeks, we just heard so much about the role of the US, but also just how much the United States ignored the fact that Honduras was becoming a narco state bit by bit. And we heard about how the United States had known, because if they were working with these co-conspirators that were working alongside Juan Orlando Hernandez, some of them turned themselves in to the US government in 2013. And so they had all this information, the US government had all this information about how a narco state was growing in Honduras, and they did nothing about it. So those were the main things for me that came out during the trial in the Southern District Court.
That's the voice of Karen Spring. We've been able to talk a little bit about what's happened post-trial of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was the former president of Honduras, and we got to talk about what the Honduras Solidarity Network is doing to call attention to the results, but most importantly, talk about what we can do as people who live in the U.S. to stand up against U.S. intervention in Honduras and work to support people feeling free and safe and having their needs met in Honduras. So thank you so, so much, Karen, for all your work. And again, remind people where they can find out more about the Honduras Solidarity Network.
Sure. People can go to hondurasnow.org to check out our campaign. It's under the Narco Trial Campaign. People can also check out our social media, Honduras Solidarity Network, Facebook, and Twitter. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
We're now going to feature Omar Sosa. Omar Sosa is a loved musician who will be playing at Yoshi's this Friday and Saturday, and will also be playing at Cuamba on April 1st. We're going to hear some tracks off of his latest release, and we'll also be featuring a little bit of sound from his new documentary, which is just released. It's called Omar Sosa's 88 Well-Tuned Drums. And so you can also access the soundtrack by the same name. So we'll play a little bit of that, and you'll get to be able to get a taste of it. And we recommend that you check it out at omarsosafilm.com, and you can find out more there. So please enjoy some of this music. If you want to see Omar Sosa, we recommend that you go to Yoshi's website, and you can hear him play at Yoshi's with his Cuarteto Americanos. And that will be this Friday and Saturday, March 29th and 30th. And you can also catch him at Cuamba, which will be April 1st. So don't miss these great opportunities to see the incomparable Omar Sosa. Enjoy.
The candle and the red scarf. Actually, the red is not only red. Inside of the red is something black.
The scarf with the, yeah, with the black scene inside, but you don't see the black scene. You know, the black scene is the darkness, and the red is the light and the power.
This is Elegua. It comes from the Afro-Cuban tradition, especially Santeria. Always the candle is there. It's like a symbol for me to let the spirit know we are ready to receive.
Today,
Iculo Biocha,
you'll witness an event of considerable musical magnitude. Omar Sosa is a major figure in the currently evolving international musical scene. Noted critic Don Heckman described him in the Los Angeles Times as, quote, a rising superstar, end quote.
I first heard Omar's music in the mid-90s, and I think what first struck me about his playing was that it was the kind of thing I had trouble situating. It wasn't quite fish nor fowl. Definitely an element of jazz, but you could also hear perhaps a kind of what we would now say post-classical feel to it. And even though it wasn't explicit, there was definitely the echo of his Cuban roots. Those rhythms were still echoing through these piano pieces, which could be quite contemplative at times. ¶¶
but he's not, you know, the kind of virtuoso that everybody expects from the cliché of Cuban or Latin musicians.
Omar is not like a Liszt-ian virtuoso, like in the Russian classical school.
Not a flashy virtuosic pianist.
But there are different kinds of virtuosity.
El virtuosismo no está en la técnica, no está en la velocidad, no está en los excesos, está en la creatividad.
He will establish a vamp, kind of a motif, and he'll kind of hold it up to the light. You know, he'll kind of admire its various refractions.
I mean, he can burn. He can play fast, and he can play notes that make sense quickly.
His virtuosity is more this ability to weave together these different musical threads.
Entonces, eso se nota cuando tú oyes tocar a Omar, aunque tú no lo veas, tú sabes que ese es él. Ahí es donde está el más grande de los virtuosismos.
Omar was always someone that was trying to do things different.
Totally unique. He felt like music was sort of flowing through him.
He has his own style.
That actually was what drew me to him.
What I like about Omar's records...
kind of a mixture of everything.
Because he wasn't like other pianists.
Different every night.
I never know what he's gonna come with next. I've never seen him do the same set show twice.
Latin jazz, jazz.
I always hear the tumbao and the Cuban thing.
Electronic.
Not even close.
Fusion to jazz.
Mucha cubanía.
Indian touch, African touch.
Mucha africanía.
Jazz, you know, world.
He belongs to any place in the world. He's a citizen of the world.
Maybe if you had to type him, he'd be more of a conceptualist.
There's some new conceptual angle to it.
I don't know if he would call himself a jazz musician.
I'm not a jazz player.
And I'm not sure I call him a jazz musician.
For me, this music is a color.
It's African, Cuba, and many things.
I think that you need to create a box, and the box says Omar.
It's Omar music. Red, blue, and violet.
Because the acoustic sound for me is the most important thing. Without a piano, I die.
You were born and raised in Cuba.
Oh, yes, yes.
Give me a little idea of your life prior to becoming the touring musician that you are now.
I studied in the School of Camagüey, my hometown. And after that, I moved to the National School of Art in Havana and also the university. But the funny thing here is, I never studied piano.
Percussion, primarily,
yes,
right?
It's my main instrument. I studied percussion. This is why I look at the piano as a percussion instrument, like 88 drums.
Once we started in the school, there was a lot of Russian teachers at the time. Then you're trained to become a classical musician.
We used to do chamber music, orchestral music, but not Cuban music.
And so they were taught the classical canon. Jazz had no place. Cuban folkloric music had no place.
We didn't have like a drum school. It was vibraphone, xylophone, timpani, but all classical oriented.
So back in the days when I was in the school in Havana, National School of Art. We all try to look for good music, and actually we have the opportunity to grab FM radio, which come from Miami, but you know, was prohibited in the school. And I remember we have a little small radio, and we all put our mattress in the floor, and the radio in the middle. So a lot of mattress was like this, and the radio, and everybody was fighting. The first music we listened was Hair, Wind, and Fire. Do you remember
when it first died? Listening to Miami radio was a whole thing in Cuba. And of course, they didn't exactly get the cutting edge music. They, in many ways, got the commercial crowd.
Chicago. Baby, please don't go. Toto. Africa. Comodoro.
We can't imagine what it's like to live in a situation where listening to Elton John at night has a subversive cast to it.
Shalala. Actually, a friend of mine, his father was a violin player of Orquesta Aragón. This is one of the few bands that had the opportunity to travel outside Cuba. I remember he brought two records. He brought first record was Oscar Peterson. And the second record was Weather Report.
Thank you. rainha das águas doces e salgadas. Abençoe-me, proteja-me, odoia.
Thank you.
águas doce e salgada. Abençoe-me, proteja-me, Odoia, Eruia.
You've been listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. If you'd like to stay up on our news, like us on Facebook, at La Raza Chronicles on Facebook. If you want to hear this program or share it with a friend, you can go to soundcloud.com/La Raza Chronicles and share it. If you have any ideas for interviews we should be doing or would like to get involved with our collective, you can email us at LaRazaChronicles@kpfa.org. Muchísimas gracias y buenas noches.